From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. The August 9th shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson touched off a firestorm of response from city residents and brought the media to town. Today, we look at how journalists have been covering events in the St. Louis suburb with our media critics. Has the sheer number of correspondents there done more to fuel citizen response? Are they reporting the facts of the story or becoming part of it? And what role has social media played in all this? Tweet your thoughts at KCUR up to date on the job the news community has done in Ferguson. Plus, Brian McTavish will be here with our weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Can two things be true at once when it comes to the ongoing media coverage of the situation in Ferguson? The media, some critics say, has become part of the story. At the same time, many believe the media must be in Ferguson to chronicle one of the year's biggest stories and how police are handling the ever-present protesters there. Still, there are no shortage of folks who insist that the media are egging on the protesters and changing the story as a result. Today, we'll run all of this down with our very good panel of media critics. They are Derek Donovan. He's the public editor for the Kansas City Star. Derek, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Pam Fine is also here. She's the night chair for news, leadership, and community and a professor of journalism over at the University of Kansas. Pam, welcome back.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And also with us this morning is Frank Morris. He's KCUR's national reporter who returned this week from Ferguson, where he was reporting on the situation for NPR and KCUR. Frank, good to have you.
Hey, Steve.
Too. Well, let's start with the basic question here, Derek. Has the presence of a huge media contingent in Ferguson fueled this story? Has it energized the demonstrations or not?
You know, it's one of the classic chicken and egg stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think you have to look at a story like Ferguson through a different lens than, for example, the very regular protests that there are down on the Country Club Plaza. You know, there are a lot of peace demonstrations down there. Those are also a different type of protest. And the Star and most media outlets are really circumspect about covering those because a protest, by its very nature, most of the time is designed to attract media attention. And while they can draw big numbers and they can often have a message that is worth communicating, the Star, you know, always tries to pull back from it, and they've got some guidelines about the number of people that need to be participating in order to generate a brief or a photo, that sort of thing. Here in Ferguson, it's a lot more organic, and I think that it has a news value that's inherent, but at the same time, you have the question is whether these folks are intentionally playing to the cameras, and by getting that audience, are you, you know, really exacerbating the problem.
Well, Pam Fine, there's no question that some of these demonstrators are playing to the cameras. Is there? I mean, that clearly has been going on over there.
Yeah, you certainly see that if you watch CNN at night. You see people lining up and trying to get on camera. But I do think there's a legitimate groundswell of interest in this case from people who, you know, want justice. And had they not been as activists as they are, then we might not have seen the attorney general there and had as much scrutiny to this point that we've had. So I think news coverage, word of mouth, social media is all attracted activists and regular folks and media to a site. And I think the results of that, even though it's been uncomfortable at times, will be positive.
Well, bottom line, then, the media is changing the story there. What's happening in Ferguson is different because of this massive horde of reporters sitting over there.
There's no question. And one of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporters tweeted, I'm not sure how literal he meant this, but he said there are two reporters for every protest the other night. Right.
Yeah.
And there, at that point, the reporting on it is like you said, it's intertwined with the story in a lot of ways.
Yes. Frank Morris from KCUR, you've been over there. You've had tear gas sting your eyes. You know what all that is like now. What's been your sense watching the demonstrators? Are they playing to the cameras, or at least some of them? Is there any question about that?
No, I don't think there's any question about that. And it's also the case that there are reporters there who are not reporters in the sense that you and I are, Steve. You know, they're activist reporters. And they are actively egging on, as you say, the demonstrators. They're trying to move them forward. They're encouraging them. They're trying to get them to do stuff.
And they're doing that how, Frank?
Just by sort of shouting encouragement to them and asking loaded questions like, can you believe that those guys came out here and flashed their light? What do you think about that? That sort of prompting. By the time I was there when they first imposed the curfew, and for a long time the curfew was not imposed. They let people just kind of blow off steam, but you had and eventually a lot of people left. By the time the police rolled on the protesters, it was about 1-to-1 protesters and photographers in the street. And so a lot of these folks, you know, who come in from around the world to cover this are really well prepared. Unlike me, they have gas masks and helmets, you know. And so
didn't have that luxury, eh?
I didn't think about it. But the media is a part of the story. You know, not just folks getting arrested and that kind of thing, but also the different parts of the media are really taking part in this.
Well, Pam, the problem is you teach journalism, I teach journalism. In theory, that's not how it's supposed to be. Journalists are there to observe, right?
Right. And one of the key things that disturbs me, not only with this story but other stories, is the broad brush use of the word media, because you do have professionally trained journalists like Frank who use good judgment, abide by ethical standards, comport themselves well. And then you have other people who have absolute right to be on the scene and to try to get information, but they probably don't have the professional training that most of us in this room have had. And I think that's important to recognize. Mm-hmm. But it's a problem when now anybody can be a reporter and disseminate information. How does the people on the ground who are trying to keep things safe, and how does the public discern between those of us who feel we have an ethical obligation to be fair and accurate and unbiased, and those who perhaps don't?
Derek Donovan, hop in here.
You know, in the 10 years plus I've been talking to readers about news coverage, one of the themes that continues to come up is something that I hear expressed from leaders in a lot of different movements. The peace movement has said this. The conservative Republicans have said this to me from Kansas, where they have encouraged the Star not to always look for the first person who wants to talk to a reporter, because they've got a real problem with folks who are enthusiastic and want to try to get the message out, but who actually ultimately get off message. Hmm. I remember very distinctly two prominent leaders of the peace movement here in Kansas City who had a guy who was constantly contacting reporters wanting to offer himself as a source, and they didn't want the guy talking for him because he had kind of muscled his way into the organization and didn't really have their support. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that these activist journalists, these folks who, you know, they run their own blogs for whatever their concern is, they like those types of folks. They're bomb throwers, and they often, you know, are not really concerned with what the ultimate results from their words might cause.
Hmm. Let me put in too, Steve. I mean, you know, the big dynamic is that this small cadre of insurgents or, you know, really hardcore violent looters, there's tiny, tiny percentage of what's going on there, but they are the most interesting and the most, you know, dynamic photos. And so everybody's going to take pictures of them, but the coverage, I think, it's really distorted when it focuses, it gravitates naturally towards these interesting, dynamic characters where there are tens of thousands of other people who just keep coming and coming out to these over and over again, deeply moved and peacefully to these protests. Those folks, of course, get much less coverage because they're just not as interesting. You know, they're not as compelling.
So the picture of Ferguson that's emerged, you're so right, is what we see at midnight over there and all this, you know, the Molotov cocktails, right, and all that stuff. You're saying the scene during the day, that the scene during the early evening hours is completely different.
It is, and it's profound, and it's big, and it's, you know, it's moving to see so many people coming out over and over again, clogging the streets in this tremendous sense of unity that exists there. Then that's clearly been reported on, but that's not what you see. You know, that doesn't pop out at you the way that the smoke and you know, people kneeling in front of armored vehicles. And
Pam
stuff.
Fine from the University of Kansas, the great J School there. Why does that happen? What Frank just said. Why is the picture that gets portrayed of Ferguson just what Frank described? It's the real flamethrowers over there, literally and figuratively, that come out after midnight, as opposed to what's happening during most of the day. And isn't that a distorted picture?
Well, it is, if that's all you're seeing. It speaks
that's
to
what
my,
I'm seeing.
Well, but,
I'm watching.
But
getting,
you also see police officers with what looks like military gear. And I think that's important to report. There's a lot of conflict and tension. That's at the heart of this story. I do think that the fuller story is being told. You might not see that if you're only tuning into one or two sources. I mean, there have been some excellent stories on, you know, what's at the root of this problem, both in terms of police activity and how the police view young black men in that area and beyond, and also the economic disparities. So there have been a range of other types of stories. But TV needs images, and images, involve people, and anything that creates tension apparently seems to be make for good images.
Derek Donovan from The Star, do you buy what Pam just said? Has there been a full menu of stories on this whole Ferguson caper or not?
There's been a lot of good reporting on it if you are one of those folks who wants to seek it out. Unfortunately, in the distribution channels that we've developed through social media, those aren't the stories that are getting as much prominence. They're certainly not the photos that people are sharing around as much, just because the readers are the ones who are selecting it. It ends up being, you know, very much a populist kind of a popularity contest, really.
Yeah.
And people are much more interested in the pictures of the Molotov cocktails. But yeah, there's been some great reporting from a lot of different sources.
Let me get our listeners to engage here. What do you make of the job the media has done reporting on this intensely controversial situation over in Ferguson? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Just bottom line at Pam Fine, what kind of job has the media done? Give the media writ large a grade here, or can you do it?
I don't like to do that, to be too simplistic. I do think there's a lot of good reporting to be done in the future, that we really have to address the racial divide in these communities, the economic divide, and the way police interact with minorities in this country.
Frank, your sense of what public radio has done well, what public radio could have done better, maybe?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think St. Louis Public Radio, I know you're having them on soon. They've been heroic in their coverage of Ferguson, not just because they've had people on the ground in sort of moderately dicey situations, but they've covered this very, very broadly. I'm going to kind of contradict myself, but for the first few nights, public radio didn't have people out on the ground when things were getting very, very tense. And so, you know, I think that's kind of where the rubber meets the road in a way, too. So, I mean, I think public radio did a great job, has done and continues to do a great job of covering the broadest aspects. And they've got their code switch team in there working on this.
What's that, Frank?
That's a whole division of NPR that works on nothing but racial issues.
Huh.
And so they're bringing a lot of expertise. They've got Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department, you know, covering this, you know, all the time. So they've got a lot of resources from a lot of different perspectives coming in. I mean, as a as a you know, hard news guy, I think they could have been a little bit more on the cutting edge of where the conflict was in the beginning. But otherwise, I think NPR is doing a great job. And St. Louis Public Radio, can't say enough about them.
Derek Donovan, your sense of the media and how it's covered this story, what it's done well, what it hasn't done so well.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we all have to try to resist is the urge to try to put this into a narrative structure. You know, I think one of the failings, and I think pundits are particularly guilty about that, is we want to cast these types of stories into what we already think, you know, and people who are suspicious of the police just automatically go that way, and people who think, oh, you know, the black crime problem is to blame here, they automatically seize on that. So a lot of this is made a lot worse by the fact that the police have not been forthcoming at all with their side of the story. And so that's what's allowed a vacuum here to open up to let just one part of the narrative take hold, especially in the pundit class.
Yeah.
But I always try to remind people that life isn't a story. Life doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. You know, life is just a series of events. And people try to make sense out of it by putting it into these structures that are literary in a lot of ways. I think that's a great downfall of all media, and particularly in a case like this.
Yeah, I want to talk in just a minute about it from my view, what a difficult story this has been for so many mainstream outlets to cover. But first, I want to go to some phone calls here. Charles from Olathe. Charles, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the media coverage over in Ferguson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, the one thing I think they're downplaying, I think they've done a good job overall. One thing I think they're downplaying is something that happened yesterday. Everything was going fine, but suddenly two people showed up to support the officer with signs, and they were escorted out of there quickly when they were quickly with some anger and people punching their fist and wanting to get to them. And for their safety, they were driven out fast by the police. And it just reminded me that everybody's crying for justice and freedom. What about, is there room for an opposing viewpoint, you know? And if not, it reminds me of like ISIL, you know, like the Middle East. If you have any opposing opinion, you're going to get killed, basically.
You know, Charles, that's an interesting point. I am wondering about sort of the pro-police side, you know, of this story, the notion that perhaps we don't know all the facts yet here, that maybe the police, it's possible the police officer acted completely appropriately here, given the circumstance he found himself in with Michael Brown, Derek.
And I should note that one of the most viral stories about this in the past few days has been an op-ed that was written by a veteran Los Angeles police officer.
Yeah, it came out yesterday, I
came out day before. Yeah, it's been out this week, yeah. And the Star has that op-ed up right now where he's saying, this is what you do if you are somebody who is being approached by police, you know. There is some defense of that, but again, don't forget, the police have not released virtually any information about what's going on. Everything we hear about the condition of the officer and how he may or may not have been physically assaulted is all hearsay at this point. They have been so tight-lipped about it that is what has allowed people to make their own assumptions as to why that is.
Pam Fine, your sense, has the other side of the story been told here adequately or not?
Well, not adequately, because as Derek said, that the police have not been transparent. But another issue that the caller raises and Derek raised is police comportment. I mean, the police have – one of the problems for the media and for the protesters is that the police have not clearly defined how and where the public should gather, should express itself. And so the rules are being made up as they go. And so when you had initially two photographers, reporters arrested at McDonald's, and you see the police arresting reporters – it's not that most of these reporters are acting in any unusual way. It's that they're going where the public is going. They're trying to get the story. And the police don't like that. And there are no clear rules. So one of my key pieces of advice to police departments is try to anticipate these situations in which you're going to have a lot of people on the ground. How do you want them to conduct themselves and where? Because things just get out of hand around otherwise.
Frank Morris from KCUR, did you have any interactions with police over there? Were they helpful? Were they not helpful?
They're mostly helpful. A lot of, you know, there's it's such a big messy situation though, and then you know they can't train for this. They can't get ready to take over this enormous big box mall and make it their headquarters, and then you know respond. And so I was stopped by police. I was prevented from entering places by police. I had to sneak around. Most of the police officers I spoke with were really nice and really helpful. Some of them were kind of threatening, not personally to me, but you know, you go down there and you're going to get you might get shot by the police if you go down this way. I'm telling you, don't do it. So, yeah, you know, and I think, though, that there is a counter narrative among the protesters. It's not like everybody. I mean, there are a lot of people who are very passionate and ready to hang Officer Williams. But there are quite a number of people who are a little bit more sitting back saying, well, you know, I mean, that kid should have known he's a black kid. He's going to get shot if he gives a police officer. And then, you know, and more recently, I've talked with people, you know, look at the way the bullets were, you know, he fell forward. I mean, these are black people involved you can kind of see it both ways. But, I think that. People are putting themselves in danger going down there with signs supporting that police officer because there's so much hatred.
Let me just throw this out. You know, my sense of the story, again, watching it from over here, the sense that I had, Derek Donovan, that early on at least, there was a lot of hesitancy on the part of the mainstream media. Should we go over here and cover this thing or not? Was it this story of police brutality, or was this something different where a young man was too aggressive and confronted a police officer and just asked for trouble? And you did have a sense, at least in the early part, in the wake of the shooting of Michael Brown, that the mainstream media held back a little bit.
I would agree. And I think that's a classic example of traditional news judgment versus the incredible speed at which news gets shared these days.
Via social media.
Right. Especially when you're looking at this story via Twitter, because this is such a Twitter hot topic. And there is a place where wanting to make sure that traditional newsrooms are keeping current butts up against what a traditional journalist would want to be, you know, a little bit standoffish at first to see whether there is anything here. And again, I can't say enough about how the lack of police comment on this story in an official capacity really muddied the waters. It continues to muddy the waters, but especially in the early hours after it happened, when it was being reported on Twitter by non-journalists.
Well, and there's a contrast there with the way the St. Louis County police handled that shooting of the knife-wielding guy, I guess yesterday, where they were out, you know, immediately the chief, I think, or the county sheriff or whoever was out there immediately answering all the questions. They released a video. They're trying to handle it just the opposite the way the Ferguson police handled the shooting of Michael Brown.
So you think the Ferguson police did themselves a huge disservice? They should have been more forthcoming about what happened here?
Oh, yeah. I think this is going to be a turning point in that department. I think that this is a crucible that, you know, they really are learning how to make all the wrong moves.
It's
early on.
It's a textbook. You know, you leave the guy out there for 4 hours, I think, on the pavement while the neighbors kind of circle around neighbors take it, some of them as a sign. Oh yeah, you know, this is what happens. You know, you just want to let you know this dead guy with his brain splattered all over the street. That's what happens if you know. And so there were so many things that they did wrong. They could, it was just, you know, crazy. And then to releasing the video when they did, and of the convenience store video and everything.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Charlotte from up in Cameron. Charlotte, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't mean to take the discussion in a reverse direction, but in response to what you said about why the media focuses its attention where it does, in the 70s, there was an ethnographic filmmaker that learned a lesson focusing a ritual in an indigenous culture, where the lens of the American cameraman was focused on an intense part of the ritual, which was the chopping off of a little finger of girls, whereas the people of the culture themselves, their attention was focused elsewhere. And he coined the term peaky, P-E-A-K-Y, and he said, Americans are a peaky society. We focus on the most intense, most dramatic thing going on, instead of being willing to step back and get the big picture. And I think the direction our media has taken in the last 40 years has just intensified that. and I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Charlotte, thank you. Makes sense, Pam?
Definitely. And I, you know, we can't help but be in a competitive environment in which people are trying to get information first and, you know, break news, break pictures. And so the intensity of the pursuit is really at the heart of this, that there's airways to fill, goats to feed, and it just becomes a real race to get information and put it on the air. And sometimes good judgment isn't used.
Yeah, I also was wondering, Derek, before we go to a break here, this idea that this notion that you alluded to earlier, reporters injecting themselves into the story. On Monday night, CNN's Jake Tapper blasted the authorities their heavy-handed response to the demonstrations, which he deemed nonsensical. Wes Lowry, the Washington Post reporter who was arrested last week along with a Huff Post reporter, called police conduct militarized and aggressive. Don Lemon on the air for CNN even offered personal assistance to the parents of Michael Brown. What do you make of that? This is, again, a departure from where mainstream media traditionally has sort of lived.
That's certainly true. And I think that you have to really look at the big cable networks' personalities as a really different thing from, let's say, a public radio reporter or a newspaper reporter, because their brand is their personality. And they are as much kind of selling a lifestyle and a person as they are delivering the journalism.
Yeah.
But it's something that should give any journalist, any professional journalist pause.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll continue our good conversation here about the media's coverage of Ferguson. After we come back, we'll be joined by Margie Freivogel. She's the newsroom editor for St. Louis Public Radio. You just heard KCUR's Frank Morris praise the work of St. Louis Public Radio. We'll find out how they've approached this story and the challenges they faced. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This segment, we're talking about the media's coverage of Ferguson with Derek Donovan from The Star, KU's Pam Fine, and we're joined now by Margie Freivogel. She's the newsroom editor for St. Louis Public Radio. And Margie, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Good to be here, Steve.
Fill us in, if you would, Margie, on some of the logistics of covering a story this fast-moving, this complex as what's been happening in Ferguson the last couple of weeks. How have you done it?
Well, it's been a kind of surreal period of time is the only word I can think to describe it.
Yeah.
This all blew up very suddenly, beginning with the shooting on a Saturday, and then on Sunday, protests and demonstrations started. That's been almost a couple weeks ago now. And we went from being a very sizable and serious newsroom to being a 24/7 operation that aspired to do more than just cover the breaking news.
And aspiring to do more than covering breaking news, you mean what by that, Margie?
Well, as you know, this is a very complex situation, and the underlying issues that that blew up in the last couple weeks existed before that, and they're going to exist after the media spotlight moves on, and those are the things that we want to be sure we're paying attention to.
Did you guys hesitate, Margie, at least in the early going here, in trying to wrap your arms around exactly what kind of situation did you have? I mean, was it a case of police brutality? Was it a case of a young man who went too far? Did that give you some pause in terms of how you weighed in here on this story?
Well, I guess we still don't know the answer to that question,
yeah.
But it was pretty clear right from the beginning that this was a very emotional thing that people felt very strongly about, and so we knew we needed to be paying attention to it. But I do have to say that every day I've had in my head some idea of what I thought was going to happen, and I've been wrong almost every day.
Mm-hmm. So you have reporters in your newsroom, I gather, Margie, working tons of hours here trying to keep on top of this thing.
We do, and we're fortunate. You know, the St. Louis Public Radio and the St. Louis Beacon merged several months ago, and that means we have a newsroom that's now twice as big as either organization would have had separately, and we have a lot more capacity to cover something like this, We had a few new reporters who we had just hired who came on board within the last week or two, and they've been thrown right into the thick of things.
Yeah, welcome to St. Louis, eh?
Exactly.
Yeah. How do you differentiate St. Louis Public Radio's approach to covering this story from that of some of the national outlets that have been covering Ferguson as well?
Well, first of all, we start with a much deeper understanding of what Ferguson is, and we're speaking to an audience that wants to hear about things in a somewhat different way. And I think, you know, writing or reporting for a national audience is a somewhat different thing, but I think people here who see that coverage inevitably feel like it's a little bit of a caricature of reality, and we're trying to report the reality.
Do you think the media, to what extent do you believe the media, Markey, has become part of this story over there? What are your concerns? What are your thoughts there?
Well, there's no question that the presence of this huge international stage has an effect on what's happening. We just can't ignore that. At the same time, people are paying attention to issues that do deserve to be in the spotlight. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
How confident are you that this story appears, at least as of today, to be at least the initial turmoil, the street demonstrations appear to be winding down over in Ferguson?
Well, I'm not totally confident about that. It seems to be heading that way, but I think we'll see what happens tonight. Last night there were huge thunderstorms that rolled through, so you know that broke things up a little bit. But there are going to definitely be flashpoints down the road. When the officer is or is not indicted, if he is indicted, when he is or is not convicted, we've got many more potential points of explosion on this.
Hmm. What kind of feedback have you received from your listeners, from your readers, Margie?
Mostly very, people are very gratified that we're covering it in a measured tone and trying to look at the situation in depth. We have had some complaints. I had one call from someone who said, why are all the reporters talking about this as an issue that involves race? Because we don't know what the motivation of the officer was when he shot Michael Brown. But I think my point of view is clearly that regardless of the motivation of the officer, there are a lot of issues that involve race that play into what's going on.
Derek Donovan from The Star, why don't you weigh in here on what St. Louis Public Radio has done? Maybe you have some questions for Margie.
Well, yeah. I think Margie really hit the nail on the head where she said that they bring a perspective on this story that the CNNs of the world can't bring because they know their community.
Yeah.
And Margie, one of the things that I'm curious is, you don't have to name any names here, but have you seen some things where you think the perspective of these sources who don't know your area and don't know the dynamics have just kind of fundamentally gotten something wrong?
Well, there are a lot of half-truths that are, you know, keep being referred to. And so when you, they're not entirely wrong, but they're just not quite right. That's what I see going on.
Half-truths like what, Margie?
Well, for example, it's been portrayed as there's a generational divide in the way people have responded to this. Well, it's true that the people who are out at night after the peaceful protesters, for the most part, go home, they are young, and they're not listening to people who are trying to urge them not to loot and not to engage in violence. But the people out in the day, that's multi-generational.
Pam?
Hey, Margie, Pam Fine. I have a question for you. As you think now about what you might have covered about Ferguson and the environs before this conflagration, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, have you...
actually, the St. Louis Beacon, where I was before December, we did cover Ferguson. We went out and had sort of a town hall meeting in Ferguson to talk to people there about the revitalization efforts that were underway and what a great community Ferguson was. This was several years ago, and we also did a year-long series called Race Frankly, where we tried to draw out how race is a factor in so much of any issue that affects our region. So it's not like we ignored the issues that I think have come to the fore here. But you always realize that you could have looked at things in a somewhat different way, or maybe brought some urgency to it that was lacking. I think those are the kinds we're thinking about, the kinds of things we're thinking about as we plan what to do on the follow through.
Yeah, even this broader question, Margie, this notion that the Ferguson Police Department is predominantly white in what is now a predominantly black community, that kind of issue, had you weighed in there, or did you not really have reason to up to this point?
Well, we didn't cover that specifically,
yeah.
And that certainly is an issue. We have paid attention to the racial breakdown of the police stops throughout the region.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, as you know, that comes out from the state every year.
Margie, hang on the phone here. We've got some listener calls here that you can help us address here, at least I hope so. Ron from South Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring this Ferguson movement to some little focus. The violent eruption and all the things that have been brought together seriously by a cell phone revolution. Now we're getting a lot of pictures and audio, and people are beginning to put a narrative to it, but you cannot conclude anything. It's a circus, it's an explosion. We're getting all these different pieces put together, and sometimes it looked like Gaza, with the attacks coming from strong military arm, David and Goliath, or the kids throwing rocks at tanks.
Right.
But then in the middle of it all, you have a kid that was left in the street for 4 hours, dead, uncovered, which set people into an atmosphere we haven't seen for a long time. And Ferguson is a little Jim Crow model type of town.
Hmm.
A lot of people flighted out to these places. And there's, on the surface, it could be a beautiful New Rochelle.
Ron, I appreciate that. And Margie, I think Ron's making a point there in his own way about citizen journalism and how to regard it. How has that been a factor in how you've approached this story?
Well, the Twitter is a huge factor in this. And we've actually set up a live blog that we pull out of the Twitter feed of our own reporters and other people what we think is reliable information. If you look at hashtag Ferguson directly on Twitter, it goes by so fast that it's a blur. There is so much being posted that you literally cannot see the posts. So there's real value, I think, in sorting through all of that and pulling out some things that might be important for people to pay attention to. It's interesting, there's the focus on all the media being here, but if there were even no media here, all you would need is a cell phone and Twitter to get the word out to the world about what was going on.
Derek Donovan, let's talk about Twitter a little bit here. You've had concerns about Twitter and its impact on this story. The lead paragraph of a Politico story on this topic yesterday read like this: social media was the kerosene that turned fire in Ferguson into a national blaze. What it's less likely to be, the extinguisher. That suggests that tweets are inflaming this whole thing. And do you agree with that or not?
I think that there's more than a little grain of truth to that. I manage social media at the Star, so I am one of those people who lives my life on Twitter. I honestly bet my eyes are on a Twitter feed for a minimum of 6 hours a day if I were to string it all together. I mean, I really, really am in it. However, there's a major caveat to that, and I think that this is a really important lesson for everybody, journalists and regular people, to remember. Twitter is a really small, small part of the overall media pie. As a matter of fact, I pulled some stats this morning before I came in. Depending on whether you believe Twitter's account or a Pew study that was done on it, about 16% overall of people who use 16 to 19% who are online are in some way, quote, an active participant on Twitter. However, to Twitter, that means that they have an account and that they read a feed every once in a while. The Wall Street Journal did their own study, and they determined that 44% of all what Twitter considers active accounts have never tweeted once, and the vast majority of people tweet once a month or less.
Hmm.
So the people that are generating this blur that Margie is talking about Ferguson, are really impassioned, and that's great. It's wonderful that they're doing it, but they are a teeny, teeny, tiny fraction of the population. And part of the problem is Twitter's growth is really slowing down extremely, and Wall Street has taken note of this, because if anybody who gets into Twitter, you understand, it becomes overwhelming at a certain point. And there are so many different voices out there. You don't know who's credible and who's not, particularly when you're talking about those citizen journalists. And we've even seen some lapses during this coverage where professional journalists have done things that have been ethically questionable. And it's because journalists don't want to feel like they're out of step. You know, journalists get so much flack about, oh, you're such dinosaurs, you know. So a lot of journalists have naturally taken to Twitter because it's a great unfiltered way to get your stuff out literally instantly. But it's got some major caveats to traditional journalism.
Margie Freivogel, the newsroom editor for St. Louis Public Radio. What have you learned about Twitter in the wake of the Ferguson situation?
Well, it's been a kind of instantaneous way for us to tap into what other people are seeing, and for us to feed in verified information that we're finding out.
So it's been useful, it sounds like.
I think very useful, and also I think transformative in a way for us, and transformative for the way protests can be carried out these days.
Mm-hmm. Pam, find your thoughts on Twitter and what you've learned about Twitter in the wake of Ferguson.
Well, one thing I want to say, I think Twitter's had a tremendous influence, but I want to go back to this idea that somebody mentioned, you know, what's happening overseas and how much regard we have for the journalists who are covering these very serious protests. And it seems as if we have less regard in this country for the journalists who are covering the protests in St. Louis, in Ferguson. And I just feel like we're, on one level, we honor journalists who get into the fray, who are out in the streets with the people overseas and back home. Somehow we think they're not doing their jobs effectively. And I think they are. I think Twitter's a marvelous tool for both distribution and getting a beat on what's happening among, you know, people who have different perspectives. So it's had a big influence, I think a very positive influence. These stories are going to spike. We saw that with the autopsy report. I mean, and Twitter's a great way to get information out. As I always preach when I'm on this show and elsewhere, expand your media diet so you get information from a variety of sources and then make judgments. But if you only use Twitter or any one source, you're going to have a misperception.
Margie, before we lose you here, we're going to wrap this up in just a minute. A listener in Overland Park on our Kansas side wrote in to say this: please pardon my cynicism, but I think the media is doing what it typically does, covering the easy, superficial events that affect ratings. The underlying issues in Ferguson and other urban communities stems from racial bias, poverty, and lack of opportunity for minority communities. We all know this is what fuels these incidents. No one covers this because it means we would actually have to do something to fix these problems. What about that, Margie?
Well, I understand the cynicism, but that set of issues is exactly what we have been covering to a certain extent and what we need to definitely keep covering when everybody else goes home.
Derek, wait, you had one more thing.
Oh, I was actually just going to kind of back up to what Pam said there. One of the things that strikes me the most about these types of stories is what she's talking about, having to try to make sure you sample from a buffet of media sources. You know, I'm focused on Twitter right now because I think Twitter's where a lot of the bad info has come out in this case. However, also, I always have to remind people, if you're only getting your news from an openly partisan source of any kind, you know, if you are just watching one TV station, particularly now we've got networks that are openly on one side or the other, you're just listening to one pundit, what you hear might largely be true, but it's not necessarily representative of the whole pie. And so you make sure you don't just take that one slice.
Margie Freivogel, the newsroom editor for St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Margie, and good luck with your good work over there.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
All the best, Margie. And Derek Donovan, the public editor for the Kansas City Star. Pam Fine, a professor of journalism over at KU. Thanks for your good comments today on the situation over in Ferguson.
My pleasure.